From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll speak with All Things Considered host Ari Shapiro about his work at NPR and his favorite kinds of stories to work on.
No matter where you are in history, where you are in the world, where you are in the spectrum of wealth, class, any variable, does not matter, food is there.
Then we'll explore how people who vote along North Avenue could sway the outcome of the presidential election.
As goes North Avenue, so goes Wisconsin. I mean, Wisconsin, one of the six targeted states. We're going to really see, based on what happens along North Avenue, really whether or not we can win Wisconsin.
Plus, we'll share new local music in this month's Milwaukee Music Roundup. All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Ari Shapiro has been one of the hosts of NPR's All Things Considered since 2015. Before that and throughout his career, he was also NPR's Justice, White House, and International Correspondent. Outside of his award-winning work on air, Shapiro also wrote a memoir, performs as a singer, and has a cabaret show with Tony Award winner Alan Cumming. Clearly, Shapiro likes to stay busy, so when he's not in the host chair, he's out reporting in the field, which is what recently brought him to Milwaukee to speak with Wisconsinites ahead of the presidential election. You can hear it this week on All Things Considered, as part of NPR's Where Voters Are project. Ahead of that, he took some time to sit down with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to talk about journalism and his interests outside of work.
Ari Shapiro, welcome to Lake Effect.
It's so nice to be here in Milwaukee. Thanks for having me.
Welcome to Milwaukee to start. And just so our listeners know, why you're here in the Lake Effect studio, what brings you to Milwaukee?
Well, NPR is doing this project called Where Voters Are, where the hosts of Morning Edition and All Things Considered are each going to one swing state. And so you've already heard Mary Louise Kelly in Georgia, and you've heard A. Martinez in Nevada. And I had the great good fortune of getting to come to Wisconsin for a week. So I'm talking to as many voters and people as we can, voters and people, not only voters, but voters and also people, about how they're feeling about this election, what's important to them, what might make a difference, and finding out how the campaigns are strategizing in the state that could determine who controls the White House.
Right. Did you all pull states out of a hat?
We drew straws. I won't say which state was the long straw and which state was the short straw. No, I love the Great Lakes region. I've done a lot of reporting trips to Ohio and to Michigan over the years. I haven't spent as much time in Wisconsin. I've been to the state a number of times, but I haven't done as much reporting here. So I'm really looking forward to digging deep and spending a week getting to know people.
Well, we're very happy to have you here. And this project is something that you're doing outside of your hosting role that many listeners might know you primarily for. So can you share some behind-the-scene insights of being an All Things Considered host? And from the interviews you get to do, the debriefs, do you get to pick and choose what you get? And when are you given opportunities like this to do projects outside of the host chair?
Yeah, it's a mix. So we have four weekday hosts of All Things Considered. In addition to myself, there's Juana Summers, Mary Louise Kelly, and Elsa Chang, who's based at NPR West. And then, of course, Scott Detrow is the host on the weekends. And the nice thing about that is because two of us host the radio show each week. Generally, in a given month, I will be hosting the radio show for 2 weeks. I'll be hosting the podcast, Consider This, for 1 week. And I'll have an assignment week for like 1 week a month, which is what this is for me. So I am spending this week not hosting the radio show or the podcast, but I'm on assignment reporting in Wisconsin, doing stories that will air on the radio show and the podcast. On a day that I am hosting the radio show, we have an editorial meeting at 9:30 each morning where everybody on staff sits around the table, from the most junior people to the executive producer, and we look at what's already on the board for that day. So we might see, oh, our White House correspondent is bringing us a story about whatever the president is doing. We have a story from Israel about the war in Gaza, et cetera. And then we go around the table and talk about what else we think should be on the show. And so, for example, one recent conversation was about the scandal surrounding the Republican candidate for governor in North Carolina and how that might impact the presidential race. And as we think about the swing states that could decide this presidential election, should we be paying more attention to North Carolina? And we have those discussions, and that helps shape the program every day. We also look at the board and think, how much domestic news is there? How much foreign news is there? Where is the joy, the surprise, the uplift? What's the balance of longer pieces to shorter pieces? How do we mix it up to make sure we don't only have politics and war, but also arts, sports, business, science, and all the other things that make it all things considered?
Absolutely. So before I ask about more of the things you've done at NPR, I'm going to throw it way back. What did you do before NPR, and what inspired you to get into radio?
Well, before NPR, I was in college. I got an internship right after I finished my undergrad degree and have really never left NPR. But I grew up as a backseat listener. It was on in my house. Yeah. It was like driving around in the car as a kid, it was always on. I used to joke that the All Things Considered theme music gave me a Pavlovian reaction because my mother was always cooking dinner when All Things Considered came on. So, like, I associated ATC's theme with eating. And now I hear it every day, you know, every hour, which is a problem when you have to actually be on the radio and not salivating. But I've always loved the storytelling aspect of it. I love pursuing my curiosity. I love that every day I wake up knowing that I will learn about something over the course of the day that I didn't know about, that I get to ask people who are doing the most important work in their field, whatever that field might be, questions that might be totally basic and ignorant, and I just get to learn what they know, and that's a fringe benefit of my job. I just feel very lucky to get to do that.
I know. I can genuinely tell people when they ask about the job, it's like I really do learn something new every day.
Completely.
Could be minor fact, could be a random thing I'll never use, or it could be a big consequential
thing. I'm learning so much about Wisconsin right now.
Yeah. And growing up on NPR, you know, when you were thinking about like, oh, is this a career path I could take? Was there a particular story or journalist that stood out to you that kind of planted that first seed of possibility?
Well, my internship was with Nina Totenberg, who is such a legend. She has been NPR's legal affairs correspondent since many, many years. She started at NPR in the 1970s. And among the many things that I appreciated about Nina is that she got her start in journalism at a time that there was not an obvious place for people like her in journalism. Women were not hired to do hard news. And NPR in its early days hired people like the late Cokie Roberts, like Linda Wertheimer, like, you know, people like Mara Liasson found a home for the kind of hard news reporting that they wanted to do when the main networks were not hiring women to do hard news. And so I look up to those people because they sort of shaped the journalism field to make space for themselves in a way that I think I and others who have come after me have also continued to do. And journalism is not static. Journalism evolves, and we can help shape it through the work that we do.
As you mentioned, your first internship was with Nina, who, according to your book, was a celebrity on par with Meryl Streep in your household growing up.
Yes, it's true. When Nina called my house to talk to me and my mother picked up the phone.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, she recognized the voice immediately.
Yeah.
Sort of freaked out a little bit. Absolutely. Yeah, Nina was a big celeb. Getting to work with her, getting to talk to her, getting to this day to be friends with her and consider her a mentor is just a wild privilege.
Did you click right away? What were you feeling that first day?
It was such an overwhelming time because I had never been to Washington, D.C. before. And this was the beginning of 2001, January 2001. The Clinton administration was ending. The Bush administration was coming in. Nina would take me as her plus one to all of these events, celebrating the outgoing cabinet member from the Bush administration or the incoming official from the Clinton administration. So I was going with her to the Kennedy Center and the Supreme Court, to all these fancy events. Being this kid just out of college who had never met a senator or a Supreme Court justice, it was overwhelming, but it was also just kind of a Cinderella experience.
After your internship with Nina, you did a production job for Morning Edition from 1 a.m. to 9 a.m., I assume drinking coffee for 8 hours straight.
That was when I started my daily coffee addiction.
There you go.
I have coffee in front of me right now, as a matter of fact.
Courtesy of Colectivo, one of the best ones here. And with this production job for Morning Edition, you also started doing reporting on the side as a freelancer, and you did a lot of food stories. And I love a food story. So what's your favorite thing about reporting on all the people and the things, ingredients, everything that revolves around food?
Here's the thing about food. No matter where you are in history, where you are in the world, where you are in the spectrum of wealth, class, any variable, does not matter, food is there. And so by looking at the world through the lens of food, you can tell stories about things that might feel distant and unrelatable that become more accessible because everybody can relate to and enjoy and share food. So telling a story about whether it's MREs, meals ready to eat on the battlefield in a war zone, or a black tie state dinner for a visiting world leader at the White House, offer ways of telling stories through the lens of food that might otherwise make people's eyes glaze over.
Yeah. And you've covered a wide range of topics, you know, included in a wide, wide spectrum. You've had different titles at NPR, such as Justice Correspondent. There's White House Correspondent, International Correspondent, where you're based in London. Mm-hmm. Throughout all these roles, what was your guiding principle that centers your reporting, no matter the topic or beat you're on?
Whatever I'm reporting on, I want to be surprised. I want somebody to say something that I didn't expect. If I go out to report a story and I come back with exactly what I thought I would find, then I've done something wrong. I'll give you an example. I did a story several months ago on a wind farm coming to a coal town in West Virginia. And the story that I set out to tell was about coal workers finding clean energy jobs as the coal economy tanks. Well, I learned that I was completely wrong about two things. The first thing is that coal jobs in West Virginia and in the United States generally had tanked a long time ago. First, when automation came to the coal industry many decades ago in the 20th century, and then when fracking lowered the price of coal in the 21st century. So by the time wind came on the scene, coal jobs were already a tiny fraction of what they once were. That was the first thing that I realized I was wrong about. The second thing I realized I was wrong about is that wind turbines require far less human labor than coal mines do. And so the idea that people would go from working in the coal mines to working on the wind farm was just wrong, because a small handful of people were needed to work on the wind farm. There were some who used to work in coal, but the vast majority of people who used to work in coal were not being hired in clean energy. And that wasn't an experience of, oh, well, I got the story wrong, better not do it. It was an experience of going out and reporting and learning and letting that learning experience inform the story you're telling. And that's what I try to do no matter what I'm covering, whatever the story is, whatever the beat or the job title might be.
Well, and that learning experience plus curiosity go hand in hand.
Totally. Yeah. And being open to being wrong, being open to realizing that your preconceived notions and the ideas that you went in with don't fit the existing reality.
Now, when we prep for interviews, there's a range of things we figure the guests can say, maybe not say, what will we have to dig out or anything like that. Who or what, in your opinion, is the most intimidating kind of guest?
At this point, having been host of All Things Considered for nearly a decade, I no longer really get scared to interview people the way that I used to, but I think it can be really challenging to interview people who are so used to delivering their talking points that it's hard to get them to say anything new. And that can be either a movie star who is doing a circuit for their new blockbuster film, or it can be a senator who's on a campaign where they've been giving the same stump speech for months. In both of those situations, I go into it thinking, how can I get something real out of this? How can I get something that will be of value to listeners? How can I ask a question that's not a gotcha question, but something that will not just be a repetition of the same canned things this person has been saying over and over again? So that's the challenge. I don't know if intimidating is the right word, but that's the thing that I kind of stay up thinking about.
Yeah. And on the other end of the spectrum, do you recall, you know, and this can be intern days, early years, whatever you like, a moment where you had a learning curve with yourself or just being awkward, trying to figure out, like, how do I figure out this dynamic of interviewer, interviewee?
There are so, so many. Look, the thing that I always remind myself of in those situations is that as the interviewer, I have total power.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, especially if it's not live, I can scrap it, I can cut it. Like, the person is trusting me with their stories, with their experience. And so whatever I might do to step in it and screw up and embarrass myself, ultimately, I can compensate for. And the guest doesn't have that luxury and doesn't have that privilege. And so that's the inner monologue that I give myself to try to hit the reset button when I realize I'm doing a terrible job and embarrassing myself, which happens more often than you would know on the
right.
radio.
Well, because they hear
as
the finished product.
Like, exactly.
Know? Yeah.
If listening to the radio, people would think we all sound perfect because we're edited to sound way better than we are.
Right, right. They don't know the hours we spent whittling something down.
Exactly.
Now, from reporting on 9/11 and the aftermath to war zones to shootings in the U.S., a pandemic, constant change, you know, every day is different. Mm-hmm. Have you figured out?
From your description, every day sounds like misery.
Right. Well,
mass shootings, natural disasters, wars. Yeah.
Well, it leads into the question, like, have you figured out self-care as a journalist? I asked Sylvia Pagioli this, and she didn't have an answer.
I'm
curious what your methodology is.
Well, there are two things I would say. One is about self-care, but the other is about resilience and optimism, which is that talking to people in those situations and seeing their faith in humanity and their insistence on helping people around them gives me faith in humanity and makes me feel more strongly than ever that I can't be pessimistic and just give up on humankind, because people who have so much less power and privilege than I do have not given up. And so what right do I have to say it's not worth it? You know, there's no hope. In terms of self-care, not to brag, but I think I have a very good work-life balance. I have two dogs, I have a husband, I have a garden, I do yoga. There's a lot that I do that is not work. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm pretty good at leaving my work at work. And I also have these side gigs that are really fun. The actor Alan Cumming and I have a cabaret show that we tour all over the place. I sing with a band called Pink Martini. I made a reality TV show for Netflix that I hosted called The Mole. And so life is more than journalism. Life is more than reporting the news. I really enjoy my job as a journalist, but I also enjoy that I get to do a lot of other things too.
Yeah, yeah. And I want to, like, curious about the hosting role specifically, mm-hmm. right? It's obviously a change when you're used to being just a reporter out in the field and becoming host of ATC in 2015. What habits do you have in your life that you think help you as a host? You know, say reading a lot or any other kinds of things.
One thing is just being good at juggling short, medium, and long-term projects. Because as a reporter, I had a much smaller number of things on my plate at any given time. And as a host, I'm juggling so many plates. Which leads into the other thing, which is that as a host, you are so dependent on a huge team of people. Any given day, on All Things Considered, my fingerprints might be on 10 different things, and maybe three of those have had my full, undivided, focused attention. And three of those I've paid a little bit of attention to in collaboration with others, and a handful of them I'm just jumping and trusting that there's a net there because the producers and editors and bookers have done all of the work, and I'm just the voice. As a reporter, that's not the case.
Right.
As a reporter, you can be more of a perfectionist. You are more of a solo operator, although not entirely. Obviously, there are editors and so on. But as a host of All Things Considered, I really had to adapt to trusting the team that I work with and knowing that it was okay for me not to give everything my undivided attention, because it's just not humanly possible.
Right. Was that something that surprised you? Like, did you have any misconceptions going into the host role after being used to reporting for so long?
I think anyone who becomes a host has some control freak qualities within them. And I'm not as big a control freak as I might be, but I'm certainly more on that scale than not. So being able to let go and learning how to trust that other people would take care of it was a learning curve for me and continues to be after almost 10 years.
With being a voice throughout NPR, I feel like, and you share if you have the same perception as me, but in the past decade or so, I feel like there's been a shift where a journalist's voice has been more encouraged to not just be present, but incorporated into stories. And, you know, when I first started, it was more like, hey, you're a neutral facilitator. You don't have a personality. You don't have opinions. How have you observed this change? Do you think that's true?
I think you're absolutely right. When I started in journalism, there was a kind of view from nowhere, I say in air quotes, aspirational quality to who you are doesn't matter because you're just a journalist with a capital J. But the truth is, there has never actually been a view from nowhere. There has been a view from the perspective of the sort of bland majority, which, if we're just going to put our finger on it, is straight, white, you know, Christian, mm-hmm. et cetera.
Yep.
And what I think we as journalists and as a country have realized in the last decade or so is that people of color have experience reporting on police violence that can be valuable. Women have experience that can inform their reporting on reproductive rights that is valuable. And so I tell the story in my book about in 2004, my college boyfriend and I wanted to get married, and it was in the early days of same-sex marriage, and I felt like I was somehow going to lose my journalism card if I went out and got married because it was a key part of the culture wars. And I realize, as time goes on, that my experience as a queer person actually helps my reporting and that it isn't something I have to stuff into a box or pretend doesn't exist. I've never been closeted as a journalist. I've been out my whole adult life. But I think that which makes us who we are actually makes us more interesting as journalists, and it's something we can bring to our reporting rather than trying to pretend that you and I are exactly the same and have the same experiences and will report stories in the same way. It's okay if we report stories in a different way, and that does not mean that we abandon the pursuit of objectivity and that we become partisans and that we become advocates. I still think as journalists, we need to strive to listen and hear all voices and represent different points of view accurately and in a nuanced way. But I think that doesn't mean leaving who we are at the door.
That was NPR All Things Considered host Ari Shapiro with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. There's more to their conversation, including a lightning round of questions. And you can find that at WUWM.com. Be sure to tune in to All Things Considered this week to hear Shapiro's work in Wisconsin. It's featured in the Where Voters Are project, and it's co-reported with WUWM's Mayan Silver. And did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. In about 15 minutes, we'll hear some new local music, but first we'll explore how North Avenue, which stretches from Milwaukee's east side into Waukesha County, represents different political and economic outlooks in Wisconsin. That's coming up next on Lake Effect, on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. North Avenue extends from the east side of Milwaukee all the way west to Pewaukee in Waukesha County. The corridor passes through areas with very different economic and political realities. WUWM reporter Mayan Silver is exploring the significance of North Avenue during this presidential election year in a series of interviews and stories you'll hear this week on WUWM and nationally on NPR's All Things Considered. We start with Mayan's interview with Milwaukee-based Democratic political strategist Thad Nation. In 2020, Nation told Mayan about how North Avenue exemplifies important political shifts in Wisconsin. That conversation gave her the idea for this series.
Back in 2020, we were talking generally about politics. We were talking about turnout, trends, movement of voters in certain geographic areas compared to 2016. And you mentioned North Avenue as an important street in Milwaukee that reflects some of those trends. And so I wanted to ask you now, what is it about North Avenue that's so interesting politically to you as a Democratic strategist?
Well, on North Avenue, you really see the totality of who votes, especially in the Democratic primaries, but also in the general election. You start all the way at Lake Michigan on the east side of Milwaukee, which has some of the highest turnout neighborhoods in the entire state. These are dedicated voters that always, always, always go to the polls. And then you start moving west. And as you move west on North Avenue, you go through very important demographic changes. You go from some of the richest areas of the entire region to some of the poorest areas of the entire region. North Avenue borders 53206, one of the poorest, if not the poorest, zip codes in the entire state of Wisconsin. But, you know, a concentration of African-American voters that is critical in any statewide race, and quite frankly, one of the largest targets, especially in the 2024 race in terms of turnout. You hear over and over again how critical it is for Democrats to get back to African-American drop-off voters. And you see that, especially right through that section as you continue to go west. Then you start to get to Tulsa, which not too long ago was a Republican city. You know, 20 years ago, Scott Walker was a state representative from Tulsa, and now it's unrecognizable from a political standpoint, where it's well over 60, probably approaching 70% Democratic. And we've watched this trend go, first starting on the western part of the city of Milwaukee, and then starting to trend through all of Wauwatosa, starting on the eastern edge and going through the western edge. And then we see it jump the line as North Avenue continues going into Waukesha County, which, you know, is the heart of the Republican Party in the state of Wisconsin. We have seen the eastern part of Waukesha County start to go blue. And, you know, we were very competitive 4 years ago in the presidential race in Brookfield. You know, we continue to see that wave of Democratic voters year after year, cycle after cycle, go a little further west, a little further west. And as North Avenue continues through Brookfield into Pewaukee, we're starting to see that movement in Pewaukee now as well. And Waukesha County, 20 years ago, when Democrats used to talk about how to win statewide, it was, well, we needed Waukesha County. We needed to get at least 34% of the vote in Waukesha County. You know, Waukesha County, most people don't know, produces a third largest number of Democratic votes of any county in the state, behind Milwaukee County and Dane County. It's just, there's so many people, even when you're getting 34%, that still is the third largest number of Democratic votes. But now, in recent years, in the last couple cycles, we're getting 43, 44, 45% of the vote in Waukesha County, which is just dramatically changing how statewide races are run, because what used to be kind of the red wall of the Wow County states has been crumbling. As Ozaukee County has gone 50-50, and Waukesha County is now, Democrats are regularly getting in the mid-40s.
So those are really interesting points and trends for people locally. Like, it's interesting to know, like, hey, my neighbor in Wauwatosa now has this legislator. To see that sort of trend locally is an interesting thing to watch. Why would a national audience be interested in looking at North Avenue as a snapshot of the Milwaukee area?
Well, as goes North Avenue, so goes Wisconsin. I mean, Wisconsin, one of the six targeted states, we're going to really see, based on what happens along North Avenue, really whether or not we can win Wisconsin. Do we have high African-American turnout? Does that turnout look like it has in the past years, which has been overwhelmingly Democratic? How are we doing in the inner suburban ring? How high of a margin can we get in terms in the places like Wauwatosa along North Avenue? And then how are we doing in the, you know, outer suburban ring? How do Democrats do in Brookfield? How do they do in Pewaukee? If we see the African-American turnout high, if we see the inner suburban ring voting strongly for the Democrats, if we see the outer suburban ring performing what we have seen in recent years, 45, 46%, Wisconsin's going to go Democrat. No question about it.
Where does this area in the big picture of Wisconsin, where does the area of Milwaukee County and the North Avenue segments that you're talking about? Because you're talking about, you know, the very blue liberal core voters on the east side of Milwaukee. You're talking about Black voters throughout the different neighborhoods. There's maybe like 19 to 20 different neighborhoods throughout North Avenue that it slices through in the city of Milwaukee, or borders. And then you've got, like you were talking about, the suburbs, both inside Milwaukee County and in those traditionally Republican suburbs. What's the big snapshot there of votes? I mean, Milwaukee County is the largest source of votes in the state, right?
Correct. Yes.
So can you lay out, like, what the importance of that area would be?
So these are all, you know, the snapshots of each one of those areas is reflective of other parts of not just Milwaukee County, but the state as a whole. As we get this increasing divide between rural voters and urban voters and suburban voters, quite frankly, what we see in terms of turnout in each one of those neighborhoods, in each one of those demographic districts, that really says if it's working there, it's going to be working in cities across and suburbs across the entire state. So, you know, you can really take that as a microcosm and extrapolate out to the entire state how the Republicans are doing and how the Democrats are doing. I mean, it's almost a perfect sample in terms of if Democrats do well on North Avenue, that means that they're going to do well statewide.
And interestingly, your office happens to be located on North Avenue. So you've witnessed this for dozens of years, right? I mean,
I've been on North Avenue for 17 years. We moved in 2007, right before the Great Recession. I've seen that street go up. I've seen that street go down. It's remarkable. And it's the resilience of those neighborhoods is absolutely amazing to watch, because no matter the good or the bad, you know, the area continues to thrive. You see the people of North Avenue. You see the differences as you drive through the city. It's a remarkable change, almost block by block. You see the history. You see truly who everyone who makes up not just this city, but this region.
If you were a conservative strategist, how would you be looking at North Avenue? Like, where would you be trying to make headway, make ground? What would you see as an optimistic light for you on that street, and how would you be looking at that?
Well, you'd have to start with organizing in Waukesha. I mean, Waukesha County. What you've seen is the easiest place for gains are people that you recently lost. And so the change in voting patterns really starting in 2016 that continue to today, which especially is the fall off of the outer suburban voter, especially women, that you would have to focus, you know, you would start on the western end of this and go east, thinking that you have opportunity to pick up in Pewaukee, you have the opportunity to get voters back in Brookfield, and then also going into even western Wauwatosa, where, you know, you're looking at trying to continue to grab voters who traditionally were your voters who have recently moved away from voting for you, and trying to get those folks back. You know, also, I'll note that the Republican Party is making a push inside the African-American community and most definitely looking for votes there. You know, I think a lot of that is a lot of noise over substance, because I'll tell you, I don't see them in the community. But they especially are saying that that's one of their focuses. And so you look at them as they come east, that they see opportunity there. And it's not that even they need to pick up large numbers of African-American voters. You know, there's two ways of getting a vote, basically, because it's a zero-sum game in many ways. It's the, can you get them to vote for you? Well, maybe. But can you get them not to vote? And so you see a lot of tactics that are designed to try to drive people not to vote. You know, 2016, you know, I always remind people that Trump actually got more votes in 2020 than he did in 2016. And like, people forget that. But like, that was because 2016, one of their major tactics was to get people not to vote. And that was very successful in 16, wasn't so successful in 20, but they're trying again in 24.
Wait, you said Trump got more votes in 2020 than he did in 2016?
Yes. That's part of, you know.
Are you talking about the city of Milwaukee?
I'm talking about just overall number of votes in the United States of America.
Oh.
And so, you know, when you look at the total number of votes cast for Donald Trump in 2020, he got more than he did in 2016. And so, you know, this is, you know, that's just a factual thing. It's just that a lot more people voted in 2020 than did in 2016.
And you don't think that Republicans are making inroads with any of these types of voters in Milwaukee?
I think that that is a very hard road to climb for them. I think that that a lot of their rhetoric is very anti-city, anti-urban. I think that they are, at the same time they say they want these voters, they're doing everything they can to turn off these voters. So I think that tactically, you know, it's for them, it's more about how do we get them not to vote more than it is how do we get them to vote for us.
And if you had an issue that conservatives are making their pitch on that you feel would most resonate with any of these groups and units along North Avenue, which, what would you think it would be?
Well, it's going to be crime. I mean, crime is a issue that is of great concern to urban and suburban voters, especially if I'm in the western part of North Avenue in Waukesha County. I'm trying to amp up fear of crime, not crime in their neighborhoods, but the fear of crime coming into their neighborhoods as a scare tactic. You know, there are only really two emotions in all of politics. That's hope and fear. And, you know, you can very clearly see these two campaigns taking very different tactics. You see, you know, the Harris campaign doing hope and joy, and you can see the Trump campaign doing fear. They're going to do fear, especially on the western end of North Avenue, to try to drive their voters to the polls.
Are you going to be on North Avenue when the results come in on Election Day?
No, because it'll be very late at night. I hope to be in bed. Unfortunately, the reality is that given the fact that they didn't change the laws around counting about allowing absentee votes to start to be counted early, you know, we're going to be in for a very late night again. It's going to be at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning and everybody's going to yell, but they chose to not fix this.
But yet you'll wake up the next day and go back to North Avenue and do your work from there. Thank you so much again for telling me about your thoughts on this North Avenue project so many years ago. And thanks for sharing your thoughts today.
It was a pleasure. Thanks.
Thad Nation is a Democratic political strategist, and he spoke with WUWM's Mayon Silver. Her North Avenue series continues this week on Lake Effect and NPR. Tomorrow, we'll hear from former Republican Governor Scott Walker. A new season of Bubbler Talk is on the way, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. Coming up, we'll hear some new songs from local musicians in this month's Milwaukee Music Roundup. That's next on Lake Effect. On 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Fall is finally here. The leaves are turning, the weather is slowly cooling, and as always, Milwaukee musicians are releasing new music. Every month, Milwaukee Records' Matt Wild creates a list of some of the best new releases from local musicians, called the Milwaukee Music Roundup. He joins me now to share a few of those songs. Matt Wild, thank you so much for joining us once again on Lake Effect.
Hello, Joy. It is great to be back after a few months' absence. It's great to be asked back. I thought I was shunned forever, so it's an honor to be back.
It got a little busy around here with all of the election coverage, but we are very happy to have you here in studio. We're going to start actually with a group I don't think we've talked about before. Hello, comma, Face.
Hello, Face. Yes, this is a, I suppose you could call it a Milwaukee supergroup of sorts. This group involves, has members from past Milwaukee great bands, groups like Carolina, Maritime, the Championship, going even way back to the Benjamins. And Hello Face has been together for, I think they got together around 2017 and have played sporadic shows over the years, released maybe one or two singles, but it hasn't been until this past September that they finally put together a full-length album. And that album is called Why the Long Phase. It's a really, really fantastic album. It's what I call just kind of a just put it on album. If you're stuck for something to listen to, I don't know what I want to listen to right now, just put on this record and you can run it front to back. And it's such a delightful listen. Goes down so easy. It is this really lovely kind of jangly, very bright indie rock. You know, fans of, I don't know, bands of like, you know, like the Gin Blossoms or something, kind of a classic alt sound like that, I think would really, really love Hello Face. And the song we're going to listen to is one of my favorites on the album. It is called Quiet Nights. And like I said, it's got just a great sound, plus a little kind of synth that reminds me of The Cure. So it definitely puts me in an autumn mood. So this is Hello Face with Quiet Nights.
In those nights.
Quiet Nights by Hello Face. The next song we're talking about is from an old favorite here in Milwaukee, Kaylee Conway. I would say this song is a more produced sound than I've heard from her previously, but it still has the same kind of raw vocals.
Absolutely. Kaylee has been around for a number of years now, and she has a new record coming out in October. That record is called Partner. I think it's technically her first solo full-length album. She's put out a number of EPs over the years. Her last EP that she put out a couple years ago was called Only a Dark Cocoon, where she reworked an old Joni Mitchell song into like four or five separate tracks. That was a really, really great EP. But with Partner, it's really great to hear her kind of stretch her legs and do a full-length album of all her own original material. The song we're going to listen to is called Heart of Liquid. It is the first track on the album. And yeah, absolutely right. I think it's very produced. It kind of fits in with the overall theme of this song and other tracks on the album, where it's really grappling with modern technology in a way. There's a lot of allusions to the internet and being online and passwords and all just kind of the modern awfulness of the internet, but done in a very daydreamy, very hazy, lovely sort of way. It's a very unique take. Kaylee is always great. Her vocals are always fantastic. So be on the lookout for Partner. That comes out next month. But in the meantime, this is the lead-off track and the first single from Partner. It is called Heart of Liquid. Heart of Liquid by Kaylee Conway. The next song we're going to talk about, it feels like the kind of song you would hear in maybe a 21st century Western, if that makes sense. I'm also not familiar with the artist. The artist in question here is Maximiano. Now, Maximiano used to be in a group a number of years ago. I believe that group was called Crawl Space. But since then, they've kind of gone out on their own and become a fantastic solo artist. And they have played tons and tons of shows, a real fixture at places like the Cactus Club or Anodyne on Bruce. You can just walk in there any random night. Maximiano probably will be playing. They put together a really fantastic solo album. It's called The Real Truth. And the song we're going to be listening to from Maximiano is called You Have a Heart in Me. And yeah, it does kind of have this twangy kind of Western feel. It's very indicative of the entire album. It's this real kind of slow burn, emotional indie folk sound. Reminds me of groups like Acreville River, definitely has some vibes going on there. It's a really, really fantastic record. Maximiano, super, super talented. And it's great to have them put out this full-length record. The record is called The Real Truth, and the song we'll be listening to right now is called You Have a Heart in Me.
I knew you when the past was out of reach. Finger bones on endless empire beat. that you don't know me now. I'll wait it out. I'll be around.
You Have a Heart in Me by Maximiano. The final song we're going to talk about is kind of familiar style here in Milwaukee. I would call it, you know, shoegaze, post-punk kind of vibes.
Absolutely. This is the latest from a longtime Milwaukee band, Brief Candles. They have a new record coming out also in October, and they just released a single from that album. The single is called Murky. This is definitely a shoegaze, post-punk sound, definitely indebted to old bands like My Bloody Valentine or Sonic Youth. Groups like that. Like I said, Brief Candles has been around for a long, long time, coming up, I think, on like something like 20 years. They were originally based in Illinois, then they moved to Milwaukee. They've been here for most of that time. And the shoegaze sound, yes, I think has always been popular in Milwaukee. And it's kind of having a resurgence nationally, too. There's just a lot of shoegaze bands out there. So it's great to hear some kind of grizzled veterans still doing it and still doing it so well. I really love Brief Candles. They haven't put out a record since 2017, I believe. So really looking forward to this new one. The new record coming out next month is called Unfinished Nature. And the song we're going to be listening to right now from that record is called Murky.
Murky by Brief Candles. Now, summer is really over, I'd say. We are squarely in fall. What are you looking forward to as we get into this autumnal season?
First of all, I'm glad summer's over because it was very, very busy, and I'm glad it's over. And I also love fall. I also love that even though summer was very busy, fall is no slouch either for music in Milwaukee. On October 19th, just when you thought festival season was over, nope, it's not over. There's a big flannel fest coming up on October 19th. I'm really looking forward to that. That's outside of Boone and Crockett and the Cooperage. And they've been doing that for a number of years now and has a great lineup, great food, great drinks and all that. Maximiano, in fact, is playing that fest as well. I love this time of year. September into October is my favorite time of year. And I love, like I said, even though the festival season is technically over, it's not really over. It maybe takes a pause around the holidays, and then suddenly it's Mittenfest again, and then it's just, it's back. Milwaukee never sleeps, and I'm here for it.
Very nice. Well, Matt Wild, as always, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me.
Matt Wild is the co-founder of Milwaukee Record. Every month, he publishes his Milwaukee Music Roundup, and he shares a few of those songs with us. You can find our previous conversations at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll hear from Democratic Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin and her Republican challenger in this year's election, Eric Hovde. That's tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect.
on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.